not here. Okay. So, 1914, the war started, we know about that. 1915, that's what we talked about on exam number two. Now we're going to keep going to a different area. In particular, we're going to see if what would happen when this war would actually spread out of Europe, yes?
Is that a good question? I'm just like wondering, so is, since 1914 specifically correlates with like, I'm pretty sure it's what the Mormons believe, is that the reason why?
No, that's just the way the war played out.
Oh, because they said that like, that was when Jesus came back or something like that.
Nothing to do with that. 1914 is when Archduke Franz Ferdinand was shot, and that's when the war began. Alright, so anyways, what were things like as we know throughout 1915? Very simple. The Western Front, static, trench warfare. You did not have fluidity at all in the battle. The Eastern Front, the exact opposite. Russia is completely collapsing because they didn't have the materiel to resist the German onslaught. So, considering the way things were running, the Brits in particular decided that there had to be a way to kind of tip the balance, to kind of boost the Russians up, and by boosting the Russians, that would cause the Germans to switch from the west to the east, which would allow fluidity again in the west. Very convoluted thinking, but that was their mindset. So, what the Brits decide to do, as we know, is to attempt to open up other fronts beyond just the east and the west. So let's see if we can appear on the periphery, which would cause a reallocation of resources. England decided to use its most lethal weapon, its navy. And by the way, this was consistent with British military planning going back to the 18th and 19th centuries. The Brits viewed the Royal Navy as their nuclear option. Ultimately, after all, it's what allowed a tiny little island nation to carve together the largest man-made empire ever created in human history. And in the decade prior to World War I, the Brits would completely reform, modernize their most lethal weapon. All right. Now, as early as the 1870s, British military planners devised calculus on how big their navy would be, or need to be, in order to protect their empire. And what they came up with what was known as the two-power standard. Essentially, they would maintain a navy larger than their two closest rivals combined. Up until 1904, it was France and Russia. So, they assessed the size of the French fleet, they assessed the size of the Russian fleet, combine it together, add plus one. That was the minimum size that the English military planners would focus on. But things changed in 1904. Because Sir John Jacky Fisher would be elevated to the rank of First Sea Lord, the highest military official in the Royal Navy. He did what we assumed would be associated with reforms. So, for instance, he focused on improved officer training. You know, he wanted to make sure that all of the commanding officers on all of the Navy vessels were the creme de la creme. He also redirect fleets based on home waters. So, he would create a section of the Royal Navy that patrolled in and around the English Isles. There would be another division that would be based protecting India. There would be another that would sail through the Mediterranean. And in each theater, he wanted to make sure that the British naval presence was dominant. He also began scrapping obsolete vessels. You know, the days of the three-rigged mast sailboats, no longer necessary. Particularly with the advent of steel-clad vessels. He also, looking at what the German army was doing in terms of their reserve structure, would also implement a reserve structure for the Navy. So you went and served your 2 or 3 years in the Navy, and then you would be expected to remain as a reservist in the event of the need to call up quickly trained reserve personnel. All stuff that you would assume would be associated with reforms. But the most significant reform was he changed the two-power strategy to a one-power strategy. Instead of Russia, he focused on Germany. So now the goal was to have the British Navy be France plus Germany plus one. Ironically, in his meetings, when Bismarck was around, during the reign of the first Kaiser, England and German relations was positive. But Jackie, he began openly speaking in belligerent terms to the extent of the need to possibly destroy or cripple the German Navy. Before it could become large enough to threaten England's global dominance. Of course, if you create an enemy in your mind, there's a good chance he's going to become your enemy in real life. Questions? So what did this mean? More construction. Now, to be fair, Jackie was definitely in the right lagoon. No pun intended. Because his primary adversary was Admiral Alfred von Tirpitz. Tirpitz would be in charge of devising the Kaiser's naval policy. Now, interestingly enough, and again, this is the kind of stuff that makes Germany not necessarily clearly being the aggressor. One of the things that motivated Tirpitz when he was elevated to this position in the 1890s was British actions. During the Boer Wars, Germany was a neutral nation, and they demanded the rights of neutrals, essentially to be able to engage in free trade with both sides. But what the British began doing was stopping, searching German ships. In some instances, seizing cargo that they declared unilaterally to be illegal, to be contraband. This outraged Tirpitz, because again, they were a neutral nation. And under international law, neutral nations are allowed to freely sail the high seas. So, as the Brits acted like bullies, Tirpitz managed to convince the German parliament to pass a series of naval bills, which incrementally began drastically increasing naval spending. Prior to which, the focus of Germany since the creation was its army, going all the way back to the Prussian tradition. But now Tirpitz wanted to change that. Let's have a navy. The goal was to create 4 squadrons of 7 ships, plus 2 flagships and 4 reserve ships. So modest size, we're talking 34 vessels. That was the goal by 1917. So gave himself 20 years to do it. Why that number? Well, England had the two-power standard, but Tirpitz, operated under what he called the risk theory. He acknowledged before the German Parliament, yes, I'm not looking for to go one-on-one with the Brits. Yes, the German fleet will be smaller. But there's no need to build a bigger fleet. Because England's fleet has to guard its global empire. So, Germany could create a significantly powerful enough fleet that would be capable of inflicting damage on any other nation's fleet. But England would be stupid to attempt to stop us. Because in order for England to redeploy ships, that would leave its colonies vulnerable. And what right-thinking nation would take such a risk? So he basically said, this is enough to allow us to essentially be the naval power in Europe. We'll let England be the naval power on Earth. We don't need to be. Now, ironically, both Fisher and Tirpitz were students of the primary naval scholar in the 19th century, the end of the 19th century, U.S. naval historian Alfred Thayer Mahan. 1890, he published a comprehensive history of naval engagements called The Influence of Sea Power on History. And in this book, he argued that the deciding factor, particularly throughout the age of imperialism, going back to the age of exploration all the way up to the 19th century, was sea power. A strong nation has to have a strong navy to be able to get to that weaker nation. And if you impose your will on that weaker nation, you can take their resources. But to do so, you have to dominate the seas. So how do you do it? Naval power. He called for large-scale battles of entire fleets, similar to the way army battles take place out on the battlefield. Now, truth be told, both men viewed him as a prophet. And so if you ever have the ability to read the book and then dig deep into the policies they were pushing, it's Mahan 101. Which, of course, I get a chuckle out of because, again, he was an American. Go America. Questions? All right, so what was the result? Well, you actually had a naval race that began. Soon, both nations began exponentially increasing the line items in their budgets to produce more and more ships. But then, 1906, the Great Leap Forward occurs. England deploys the HMS Dreadnought, the grandfather of the modern naval destroyer. It made all other battleships on Earth obsolete. It was 527 feet long. It weighed 20,000 tons. It was the first ship to be armed with standard large guns, had 10 12-inch guns. And batteries of two spread out throughout the length of the ship. FYI, other ships at the time had no more than 6 guns. So right away, you have an advantage in firepower. It was also the first ship to be powered by steam turbines. So it had the ability to reach 21 knots, which was the fastest ship on Earth. After the Dreadnought was deployed, all other battleships, even to this day, are still based on the design that was achieved in the Dreadnought. But what does this mean? Well, now you got to go back to the drawing board. Because the Dreadnought is going to be able to tear to shreds a pre-Dreadnought. So, both England and Germany had to go back to square one. From 1906 to 1914, both nations tried pumping out as many dreadnoughts as possible. But England won the race. On August 1st, 1914, that's when these numbers come from, right when war began. Not that you need to remember them for the exam. England had 22 dreadnoughts on the seas, plus another 13 under construction. Plus, they tried modernizing 40 pre-dreadnought battleships. On top of 130 cruisers, 221 destroyers, 109 torpedo boats, and 73 submarines. Making the total number of around 500 naval vessels. Germany tried, but could not catch up. By 1914, they had 15 dreadnoughts with 5 under construction, 22 pre-dreadnought battleships, 45 cruisers, 90 destroyers, 115 torpedo boats, and 31 submarines. It put them at number 2. But you're talking about 250 ships to 500. Russia, they had no dreadnoughts. France had 4. Austria and Italy, they had no dreadnoughts. They had pre-dreadnoughts, but no dreadnoughts. The Ottoman Empire managed to get the Goulburn and the Breslau, which we talked about. That was about it. In the United States, well, we had 10, but that was it. 10 and dreadnought. So, again, England was way above everybody else. So now you have a navy that's larger than any other navy on Earth. What do you do with it? Well, the funny thing is, they didn't know. If you ever have the ability to read the debates and the dialogues and the communications in the Admiralty throughout all of 1914, they literally didn't know what to do with their navy. They had the strongest navy on Earth, but how do you use it? Well, they were divided just like the Army. There was some that said, let's bring all of our strength home and let's focus on the North Sea. But then there were others that said, well, maybe we should use it to try to open up other areas of conflict. We just didn't know. But here's the funny thing is, the Admiralty also recognized the risk of using their navy. They knew if they actually used it, for what it was designed to do, that could cost the loss of ships, that could cause the loss of men. And building a battleship is not cheap. So, if you use it like you're supposed to use it, you could cause yourself significant harm in doing so. So, the Royal Navy, it was decided, would be that deterrent. Just like our nuclear arsenal. I can't imagine, even in his most bumble-headed state, that even someone like Joe Biden would ever think of launching a nuclear missile. Goes back to mutually assured destruction, which was recognized by both the Soviet Union and the United States in the 1950s. But why do we still have all our aging, decaying nuclear missiles? Well, don't mess with us. So ultimately, that's what the British would do. So we're going to have this massive fleet, and we're going to threaten to use it. Don't make us use it, though. So how do you implement such a strategy? Well, what they decided to do was to create a blockade. Beginning in August 1914, they would issue a comprehensive list of contraband items. And by the way, England was the first nation in world history to list food as contraband. So any ship, say, going to Germany with food on it, that ship could be seized because food was contraband. Why? Well, the aim was to prevent the neutral nations from aiding Germany, particularly the United States. Now, granted, as we're going to see, the United States and other neutral nations would issue complaints over this breach of international law, but England didn't care. It had the largest navy. What are you going to do to us? So, they would declare that the entire North Sea would be a British zone. Any ship that tried entering would be subject to search, seizure, or destruction. And if the German ships left this region, which was considered German space, and entered British waters, sunk on sight. That was the message they sent to the world. Essentially, the North Sea was a British lake. So, travel at your own risk. Questions? Now, by the way, in addition to the United States and Norway and Sweden and other neutral nations complaining about it, Germany also did complain as well. Because again, Germany correctly assessed that this was England's attempt to starve the German people into submission. So, what are you going to do about it? Germany would get creative. They would try to use, initially, technology that they had at hand to unleash terror upon the British people. I mean, after all, if England is going to starve the German people, it's only fair that we terrify the British people and get the people of England to convince their leaders to end the blockade. So how are you going to get from here to here?
Submarines?
No, not yet. But eventually they'll do that. Initially, they would launch a blitz. I'm assuming you're familiar with the blitz of World War II.
They did the same thing in World War I, though, right? They fired bombs on them.
They would essentially attack English soil by air. Yes, yes, yes. With the goal of terrifying the British people. Now, by the way, this would involve, as you said, strategic bombing. And World War I would be the first war in human history where strategic bombing of civilian sites was utilized. Now, of course, the Germans were the first to do it. I don't have time to get into it, but I can assure you, both England and France, as well as Russia, did it as well. They would attack German sites. But the one thing that the Entente did not have was the weapon that the Germans had that they would use. Zeppelins. Vast, huge airships. These rigid ships. And again, it was like a steel inner frame surrounded by cloth and filled with hydrogen, which is lighter than air, that allowed them to rise. Now, the very first Zeppelins were actually invented by Ferdinand von Zeppelin, which is where we get the name from, not the band. The band named themselves after his invention. Although, I don't think a Led Zeppelin could fly. But anyways. Zeppelin envisioned these things being effective ways of transportation because it was cheaper to build a Zeppelin than a railroad. Because in order to have a railroad, you have to not only have the locomotive, you not only have to have all the cars, but you also may have to lay miles and miles of track. But these Zeppelins, these airships, could essentially take off, fly anywhere you wanted them to go, and then to land. No tracks necessary. In 1910, the German government gave license to the first commercial enterprise, a company abbreviated as DeLange, which is the Deutsche Luftschiffsachtengesellschaft, which is the German airship company. You can see it up there in German, right there. This company would operate 4 Zeppelins in Germany. So it was only used internally. You could go from, I think, Munich in the south to Cologne to Berlin. I forgot all of the different routes. But from its point of operation up until the beginning of the war, over 35,000 passengers would take to the skies and be flown over portions of Germany. It was very, very successful. Of course, the war happened and everything changed. Now, by the way, 1911, 1912, 1913, the German military saw the possibilities of these airships. Not only as a potential platform for bombing, but also reconnaissance. Because the Zeppelins had the ability to travel farther in the sky than anything else. They could go up 20,000 feet, which is above the cloud level. There was nothing on the ground at the time that could take them out of the sky. So, when the German military saw how successful DeLange was, they started building some of their own Zeppelins. And when World War I erupted, they would commandeer the 5 Zeppelins by DeLange, and they had 6 others that had been built by that time. So they had an air fleet of 11 Zeppelins. Bless you.
And by the way, they put them to use. This is not a picture. It's actually a drawing. Because during the siege of Liege, while Big Bertha and the Austrian guns were blowing the bejeebus out of the city, a blimp, I think it was... I don't have which one it was. They're all numbered. I'm going to reference a couple. It doesn't say on the picture. But a blimp actually flew over Liege and not only did reconnaissance, and they radioed back to the gunners so they could adjust the big mortars to hit the military strikes, but they also dropped some bombs on them as well. And unfortunately, the blimp that flew over Liege actually killed 9 civilians. When the Germans laid siege to Antwerp, 2 blimp runs went over, dropping bombs, killing another 10. During the First Battle of the Marne, which we talked about, German blimps actually made runs as far south as Paris, dropping about 50 bombs on the city. And that's the reason why, if you remember, there was a picture that I had in there of the Eiffel Tower, and they put some machine gun positions on there. That was added in retaliation after the blimps came. But after the lines materialized, they stopped doing runs on Paris. But, as a consequence of the naval blockade on January 7th, 1915, the Kaiser allowed the German Navy and the German Army to begin bombing England in retaliation. Now, ironically, the Kaiser actually originally forbade strikes on London because he feared that his relatives and the British royal family would be injured. But when England started raiding German cities, Kaiser said, fuck it, and allowed them to attack London. The first strikes began on the evening of January 19th. Several coastal runs were made, in which the Zeppelins began bombing coastal towns. Again, the goal wasn't necessarily to destroy the towns. It was about fear. It was about terror. Because never in the history of human beings had a bomb been dropped on a town. From where you could not see. Bless you. Now, by the way, these Zeppelins were huge. They were bigger than the Dreadnought. They were over about 550, 560 feet long. They traveled average speed of 40 to 50 miles an hour. If they had a good tailwind, they could get maybe up to 60. But it took a crew of 18 men to operate. Although, they could attach gun placements, because what the Brits would eventually do is when they learned of the blimps coming, they would deploy airplanes. And so the anti-aircraft gun emplacements could take out planes, because the biplanes, they only had cloth around them. So if you punch enough holes in them, the British plane's going to go down. And like I said, maximum range, 2,000 feet up. The lowest cloud level is at about 6,000 feet. So you're going high above even the highest clouds and able to go. Of course, they didn't have laser guided precision, you know, bombing sights. They just fly over and just let the things go. But still, again, terror. Terror. Hundreds of people would die. Dozens of buildings were caught on fire. Because most of the bombs they dropped were incendiary bombs. Not bombs to go boom, but bombs to ignite fires. But really the event that would achieve the sufficient levels of terror occurred on May 31st, 1915, when LZ-38, LZ is Luftschiff Zeppelin, which is German for airship Zeppelin, number 38, commanded by Hauptmann, which is like Lieutenant Colonel Eric Linsart, at 9:40 p.m. would fly over London. Now here's the thing. People saw it, but there was no early warning systems. Because again, this had never happened before. So there was no alarms, there were no blow air horns. People just looked up and they were like, what the hell is that? Well, Linhartz and his crew traveled over a good swath of the city, and in total they dropped 30 explosive bombs and 89 incendiaries. They killed 7, injured 34, completely leveled 7 homes, but 79 other fires were created. Not a lot by modern military standards, but back then, this was unprecedented. But it would be LZ-38 that would earn the blimps, or the Zeppelins, their nicknames. They became known as baby killers. The first incendiary bomb dropped by LZ-38 fell on a house that was once located at 33 Cowper Road in a neighborhood on the northern side of London called Stoke Newington. The house, and by the way, the house, there's no house there. There's just a plot of grass and there's a marker signifying what happened. So the first bomb dropped on London, landed on a house, caught on fire, and killed a 3-year-old child by the name of Elise Leggard. She died in the fire, and her 11-year-old sister, May, died 3 days later because her body was covered in third-degree burns. Well, after that, they were known as baby killers. Although, few children were actually killed beyond Elise and Mary. But again, how do you counter fear? Well, propaganda. But LZ-38's run paled in comparison to a run done by LZ-13. A blimp nicknamed Hansa. Hansa was originally one of the blimps owned by DeLag, D-E-L-A-G, the German airship corporation. This vessel was commanded by Heinrich Mette. His blimp was overloaded. It had about 3,000 pounds of bombs on it, including a 660-pounder. In his run over London, he dropped his entire payload, killing 22, injuring 98, leveling houses, textile warehouses, and he even dropped the big bomb on the Liverpool Street Station, which was one of the major rail hubs in Liverpool, including tracks that went to the subway, the underground. Well, at the time, the damage was estimated at 500,000 pounds sterling, which in modern money, I went and found some calculators, it was about $82.5 million of damage in today's money. Now the kicker is, this one raid amounted to 1/6 of the total damage caused to England by all of the blimp runs. So by far, it was the most successful. Now, all the way up until mid to late 1916, Germany continued to send Zeppelins over. In total, they made 52 runs. They dropped 220 tons of bombs. They killed 556 people and injured another 1,300. Not a lot in a country of millions. And there was no actual military impact. They didn't hit a single factory. They didn't hit a single ammunition dump or depot. But it was all about psychological warfare. For the first time, people looked up in terror. Never had happened before. Now, by the way, I can give you one personal experience which was the exact opposite. 9/11 occurred. All of the air traffic was grounded for 3 or 4 days. I remember my wife and I, we were sitting out on our porch and we were looking up and we were like, okay, this is the first time in our lives that we look up in the sky and we don't see any planes. It was so bizarre. But that's the way it used to be. You never worried about things up above. Just like you were never worried about a bunch of jihadists taking over a commercial airliner and flying it into buildings. That had never happened before. But these type of events change the flow of human history. Questions? Well, eventually, the Germans had to start crunching numbers because these airships were very, very, very expensive to make. And they weren't quite getting the bang for their buck. In total, up until 1918, 111 Zeppelins would be built. In terms of the raids, 84 of them took part in the raids because some of the raids had multiple blimps going. But the more the Germans sent the Zeppelins out, the more the Brits and the French would develop anti-air raid defenses. They would take guns, artillery, and fill them with flak rounds, bursts, and just send shrapnel flying upwards. Because if you rip enough holes in a blimp, what's going to happen to it? Plus, if you fire incendiary rounds, what happens to hydrogen?
Kaboom.
Explode, exactly. Plus, they started using huge spotlights. And they began allocating aircraft for pursuit squadrons. Heck, by 1916, there were 110 planes dedicated to patrolling the skies around London alone. So of the 84 ships, 30 would be shot down. Another 15 would be destroyed because of accidents. And of the entire 111, another 47 would be lost flying over the trenches. Either again, because they were shot down, or the English figured out how easy it was to take out a blimp on the ground. Because they had to sit in massive hangars, longer than the airships. So you fly your plane over, drop some bombs on the hangars, and cause the blimp to explode. So at the end of the day, the German high command started realizing it's not quite worth it. So what did they do? Well, they focused on the development of the first long-range bombers. This one, right here, this sketch along with this picture, that is a Gotha Mark IV, or Model 4. The Gotha cost a fraction of a blimp. But it could carry 800-pound maximum payload. So it costs you significantly less, but you can get about a third of the total payload. So you make three planes for less than the cost of one blimp, and you can deliver the same amount of bombs. Plus, only took a three-man crew. versus an 18 to fly the blimp. So you had the pilot and you had two gunners. Gunner on the front, gunner on the back. And the plane was faster. Had a maximum speed of 90 miles an hour. Almost twice as fast as a blimp. And it was good size. Had a wingspan of about 78 feet. But the Gotha paled in comparison to the largest plane developed in World War I. A plane called, I can't find it, there we go, the Zeppelin Stocken Mach 6. It had a wingspan of 138 feet. Had a 10-man crew, maximum speed of 85 miles an hour. But could carry 4,400 pounds of payload. 25% more than a blimp. Cost about a quarter of a blimp. So, a fraction of the price, you can drop more bombs. So, the Blitz continued once the planes went. But the largest air raid of the entire war, which ironically was also the last, occurred on May 19th, 1918. 41 German bombers, a combination of Gothas and Zeppelin Stockens, took off. Of those, 34 made it to London. 7 had to turn around because of mechanical issues. They managed to drop thousands of pounds of bombs. In total, from this one air raid, 9 killed, 177 injured, and the damage, around 20 million in modern money. So, effective, lethal, terrifying. Did it break the blockade? Nope. Not at all. But again, just to be redundant, if you've never looked to the sky and had fear, now the English people did. But what did they want? They wanted revenge! Which is probably the last things that the Germans wanted to trigger, but it is what it is. Questions? All right.
Well, tit for tat. England used the blockade, which triggered the Blitz, but there was still the desire to create more fronts in order to help the Russians out. And in 1915, the Easterners, the people that are looking for that soft underbelly, would get their opportunity. Because they had justification that was given to them on New Year's Day, 1915. On New Year's Day, two jihadists, Gul Mohammed and Mullah Abdul, would attack a picnic train in New South Wales in Australia. So like the Mother's Day train express that you can go to, and you can go down the Cape and you can get like a nice little brunch. One of the things that they used to do, people that lived in Australia, is they would get on these mine trains, open cars, and they would travel out into the countryside, and they would have a wonderful picnic celebrating New Year's. Well, at around 11 o'clock in the morning, an open train, so they weren't cars, again, they're just mine cars. So they're open cars and people just kind of gather and they had some seats to put in. Train pulls up to the spot where they're going to have their picnic. Located near the tracks was an ice cream stand decorated with a weird flag that nobody on the train had ever seen before. It just happened to be the flag of the Ottoman Empire. And these two guys, pictured up here, in their turbans, as the train begins to slow down, reach behind the ice cream stand and pick up a couple of rifles, and they start taking pop shots at the open-aired cars as they're rolling by. Because, you know, trains just don't stop. It takes a while for them to slow down. They would fire off 48 shots, shooting at the cars carrying men, women, and children. 1,200 total people were on board. One bullet, one of the first rounds fired, smashed into the head of a 17-year-old girl, pictured down on the bottom, by the name of Alma Cowie. She, as her head went, would fall over and slump on the lap of her boyfriend, a young man by the name of Claire O'Brien. She is the first Aussie to die from an act of terrorism in the history of Australia. Well, the train continues to roll by. The two guys ran out of ammunition, so they ran from their ice cream stand and they repositioned themselves up on the top of a hill because they stashed more ammunition up on top. It would take several hours for the police to respond, but eventually they would arrive and a gun battle ensues and both jihadists were killed. Now, by the way, there is dueling accounts that seem to suggest that one was killed dead, but one of them was still injured, wounded. Maybe not mortally, but he would end up dead shortly thereafter. Because I guess the police chief on scene said, there will be no prisoners. There will be no trial. So long story short, they both ended up dead. So we don't know why they did it. But six people were killed total, seven wounded, and of course I'm not including the jihadists, but two of the kids, two young kids, one girl who was eight and another one was six, were among the injured. Well, when news of the events that took place on Broken Hill was put in the papers, the Australians demanded blood. But here's the funny thing. They blamed the Ottoman Empire. And so the mobs would go around the German cities, but you know something? There was no presence from the Ottomans, other than a bunch of miners. Because these two guys, before I forget, they were part of a group called Cameleers. In 1910, some of the Australian mining companies experimented with importing camel to use them to transport the ore away from the mining areas down towards the railroad stations because camels were cheaper to raise and maintain than bullocks. The big bulls that were natural are to Australia. So they brought in a whole bunch of camels along with a whole bunch of people from the Ottoman Empire, of which the two guys were associated. So other than that crew, there was no other Ottoman or Turk in all of Australia. So what did the mobs of Aussies do? They began burning down German targets. Why? Well, because 1915, the Ottoman Empire had joined the Central Powers. How bad did it get? Well, the following Sunday, the Archbishop of Sydney, on one hand, preached forgiveness of one's enemies, but also warned, kind of like tit for tat, that if you kill those who are trying to kill you,
It's okay. So now you got the entire population of Australia all fired up. They want to join the war. Where are you going to send them? Where are you going to send them? You going to send them all the way to the Western Front? Well, the Australians don't have enough men to be able to tip the scales in the advantage of the Entente. You going to send the Aussies to Russia? Well, A, how are you going to get them there? And B, they're Australian. They're not used to the climates of Russia because it gets cold in Russia. So where are you going to send them that they can be most effective? No.
Turkey.
Tobruk.
They fought Tobruk, right? The Australians?
Yeah.
I don't know why I was thinking Russians.
That's all right.
Now, truth be told, the two terrorists,
they came from the Ottoman Empire, but they weren't Turks. They were actually Afghanis who had moved to the Ottoman Empire to get into the camel business. So again, we have to be accurate in all things. But as we know, the Ottoman Empire did join the Central Powers, and so it was only right that, well, maybe we should do a blow. Australia, 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 we love it. So the Brits came up with a plan.
Again, this is the Eastern mindset. We're going to help Russia by essentially stymieing the Turks and punching through the Turkish Straits, which would allow the Brits direct access to the Black Sea, and thus they could give material support to Russia. To do so, you had to not only seize the Dardanelles, but you also had to seize today the modern city of Istanbul. So this would involve a direct invasion. First here, then penetrate the Sea of Marmara, and then there.
The goal was to expose the soft underbelly of Germany. A phrase devised by none other than First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill. He believed by ripping the Ottoman Empire asunder, that essentially would cause Germany to freak out, because they knew England could then start giving direct support to Russia. So effectively, by doing this, the entire war would be changed. Germany would then have to shift more men to the Eastern Front, which would allow the Western Front to become fluid again. Just to be redundant, because World War I is nothing but a broken record. Sounds great. What was the plan? Well, the plan was they are going to send ships, and they're going to be able to blast their way through the Dardanelles, and then they're going to be able to blast their way through Constantinople, and they're going to be able to enter the Black Sea because they have the world's largest navy. And then you have reality. One. They didn't have enough stuff to do this. They didn't have enough men. They didn't have enough ships. They didn't have enough supplies. They didn't have enough weapons. They didn't have enough fresh water. The men would end up, once they were deployed in Gallipoli, would actually have to make their own grenades by taking the head off of their bullets and pouring the gunpowders into the fragment shells. They didn't have things like optics, So the men had to get creative and make periscopes because trenches would be dug. They didn't even have maps. They had no idea what was in the Ottoman Empire other than the outline. I kid you not, before the British commanders moved the military men into position, they actually had to buy tourist maps from vendors in Cairo, Egypt. They had no idea what was there. And of course, they didn't read the language. What I'm saying is they had no intel. They didn't know what was there. They had no idea how big the Ottoman army was. They knew that there were a bunch of forts that lie in the Dardanelles, but they were ancient. They were medieval, dated back to around the time when Mehmed conquered the Byzantines. They knew the Turks had mobile howitzers, but they had no idea where they were, how many they had. They knew the Turks had deployed mines in the Dardanelles, but they had no idea how many and where they were. They also didn't realize that when the Turks got wind that the British were coming, the Turks shifted almost all of their military strength to protect the Dardanelles. So the Brits would attempt to penetrate with about 75 to 80,000 men, fighting against 370,000. Why? Well, like I said, the plan was we're going to sail our battleships through the waters and the Turks are just going to melt away. And we're going to be able to achieve our objective. Why?
Well, we're British after all, and if we say something's going to happen, what do you think, the primitive Turk is going to stand in our way?
One of the naval commanders actually claimed to the Admiralty in a report his belief how easy the success was going to be because, and I quote, of the fundamental and inherent superiority of the European as a fighting man over the Asiatic. They just assumed they would win because, and that the Turks would just not defend their country. That they would just roll over. But of course, you know, the problem is they didn't tell the Turks that they were supposed to surrender. So, you're in your, I don't care what nationality you are, but any nation, you're sitting in your country, and suddenly an enemy fleet is coming, what are you going to do?
Well, the operation began based on the original plan. We're just going to sail our ships up the Dardanelles, and we're going to achieve victory.
Because we're British.
This first thrust was controlled by Admiral Sackville Carden. In his report, he actually said that he would take Constantinople in less than 2 weeks. He would use, initially, the one dreadnought that he had in his fleet, the HMS Queen Elizabeth.
The dreadnought would be deployed about 8 miles out and would open fire. And it would pulverize many of the outer forts because their guns outranged anything the Turks had. But the problem was, is just beyond the coast, the terrain raises high, mountainous, elevated positions. And they had no idea what was on the other side. So it's not like you can fire a shell from out here and it's going to just kind of do like, whoop, one of these, and drop straight down and land on where you think it's going. If you shoot over the mountains, it's going to have the trajectory and it's going to keep going. Plus, like again, they had no intelligence. They had no idea what was here. So after they pounded the outer forts, they were convinced, we got this. This is going to be easy. So they begin sailing in. Well, much to their dismay, as they moved
into the mouth of the Dardanelles, the inner forts began opening up fire. The first ships that tried penetrating were the minesweepers, but the Turks took out several. So, knowing there were mines in there, not knowing where they were, Cardan called off the assault because he didn't want to risk hitting a mine. Two of the biggest forts was Kumalai in the south and Sed El Bahr in the north. Right there and right there. Both forts had an effective range that could basically cover, overlap each other. Nothing could get by. So after that failure, the Brits came up with a brilliant idea of deploying a small detachment of Royal Marines. They would be landed in small rowing boats, and they would penetrate the terrain, somehow get into the forts, and knock out the guns. But again, the Brits didn't tell the Turks that the Turks was just supposed to leave the gates of the forts open. So as the Marines tried penetrating the forts, the Turks defended the forts and effectively drove them away. Marines suffered a very high casualty rate. I think they lost 22 and another 33 were injured out of about 200 men deployed. So they were forced to retreat back to their landing craft. Well, when the report went back to London, suddenly London started saying, maybe we really shouldn't use men. Maybe it's not going to be effective. Maybe instead we should just use our fleet and just, again, punch right through. Why do they believe this? Well, Churchill. Churchill kept telling the War Council that Cardan needed to press the attack. If he pressed the attack, the naval ships that were there had the capacity to penetrate the Dardanelles. Now, Cardan, for all what you say about him, he did try. He tried peppering the mouth. He tried trying getting in. But again, the Turks managed to unleash so much hell, Cardan was too terrified to attempt to penetrate. Seeing the writing on the wall, his nerves actually snapped. He actually went psychotic. And so much so, his second in command actually had him removed from command because he just completely lost his nerve. So, March 16th, Cardan's out, and he's replaced by Admiral John de Robeck. And Robeck would follow Churchill's orders on paper to the T. Oh shit, it's almost out. I'll do this when we're done. He would deploy 16 battleships. 12 British, 4 French. Most of them were pre-dreadnoughts. The ships would be aligned in rows of 3. So there'd be one line, second line, third line. In these lines, like waves, they would swarm in. Leading the charge would be a bunch of minesweepers that would come out from behind the battleships and go forward to clear the area of mines. Initially, it looked like they were going to get through. The ships would hold their own against the forts. They would lay down fire, cause a lot of damage. But the Turks got lucky. A French battleship called the Bouvet was hit. Perfect landing. The entire ship blew apart. It must have hit one of the arsenals. The boat detonated. Entire crew was lost. Then the Turks realized what the minesweepers were, and they focused their fire on the minesweepers and sunk 5 of the 10. The remaining 5 had to pull back. The HMS Inflexible, which was a cruiser, and the Irresistible was a battleship, chugged forward, and without the minesweepers, actually hit mines. The Inflexible was damaged, didn't sink, managed to withdraw. The Irresistible, however, would sink, but most of the crew was rescued because it was a slow sink. Shortly thereafter, another battleship, the Ocean, hit a mine, sunk. Again, sunk slowly. Most of her crew was rescued. Then the Galios and the Suffren, two French ships, hit hard by artillery. Both knocked out of action, had to withdraw. 4 other battleships suffered some damage, minor damage, still functional. They continued nonetheless. But then a storm hit, and the currents began swooping up. And when the storm hit, Roback was terrified that if you could not control the directions of the ships, they may run aground, they may smash into each other, or again, it may rip up more mines. So, he called off the advance. He ordered a full retreat. Now, he was promised 5 more battleships, but he realized how stupid this was. 3 ships gone, 3 ships knocked out of action, 700 lives lost. Now here's the last point. The irony is if they actually came back the next day, they could have penetrated. They could have actually done it. Because the Ottoman Turks fired off 3/4 of their artillery, which was irreplaceable. They didn't have factories. The mines, most of them were hit, or some of them during the storm actually ripped open from there where they were weighed down and detonated against one another. So the Turks are sitting there freaking out, saying if they come back, they're going to penetrate. But the Brits lost their nerves. So, how's this for a what if? If only they just said, F it. Went, they could have gotten the Dardanelles. But they gave in to their fear. And what's next? Gallipoli. But we'll deal with that on Thursday. Questions? All right. Papers are due in April. One person submitted their paper early and got extra credit bonus. You have to the end of March, and you could get extra points. No pressure, though.